Hey everyone, my guest today, Michael Paul Stevenson, got really, really lucky, and then in a way got really, really unlucky. He was the child star of one of the worst movies ever made, and that hung over him for a long time. But at a certain point, he turned those lemons into lemonade. In a way that very, very few child performers, certainly ones known for being in horrible movies, ever have. His achievement in making this a 180 truly stands alone. And we talk about that today, as well as his recent release, The Attack of the Murder Hornets. And if you heard about Murder Hornets last year, you might have already forgotten about them. They were one of many stories that hit us hard in waves that sounded insane and unreal, and it's probably the one that turned out the least real for the most people. But the documentary brings up just how real this threat was for certain people, and Stevenson weaves in his own knowledge of cinema and style in the retelling of it. So while we talk about his making the doc Attack of the Murder Hornets, as well as his other projects, the real lesson buried in here, you'll find as you listen to Michael, is what inspires him to be involved, what he's witnessed firsthand that makes him believe that the work is worth doing. And it's pretty inspiring. So check it out. My first question usually to any guest is about how they got started or what inspired them in the industry. But with you, I feel like you kind of jumped around in a bunch of different areas. And I'm curious, more so specifically, what made you want to make documentaries? Because you were already working.
I mean, you know the backstory, obviously, of being the child star of Troll 2.
Wow. Yes, well, I do, and I want to get to that, but I think our audience might not.
Okay, well, so I'll try to give you the abbreviated version of what led me towards making documentaries or nonfiction, and it started as a child. I loved acting. I started doing stage when I was six. It was sort of my sport, right? It annoyed my parents, but it was the sort of thing that I loved. And it just so happens that the first movie audition I ever went on was for a film called Troll 2. Actually, it wasn't called Troll 2 at that time. It was simply called Goblin, but that's later in the story. Troll 2, I ended up getting the starring role in the film. And for me, I thought it was a big deal. Like, here, this was a dream. And, found myself in the middle of nowhere, Utah, with Italian filmmakers making a film about vegetarian goblins attempting to turn my family into plant mush. And it was a dream. Like, it was a real dream. And I thought, you know.
How old were you?
I was 10, just about 10 and a half, actually. But, you know, I thought, like, I was making a movie, like, this was a big deal, and got done with the film. I kind of just expected that a couple of months later, we'd all go to the cinema or the theater, and we'd watch my movie, and it didn't happen that way. It was a year later, Christmas morning, I'm unwrapping presents, and I unwrap this VHS of this film called Troll 2. And I was confused and thought, well, what's this? And my mom says, Michael, it's your movie. Let's put it in and watch it. And I turned over the VHS and there's my face screaming, you know, picture of my face screaming on the back of it. And we put in my movie for the first time. And my dad said, it wasn't more than a minute into it, and my dad's like, oh, Michael, this is a terrible, terrible movie.
And you were about 11.
I was about 11 at that time.
I want to go back to one part of this, which is, was your dad, you say your parents were not encouraging of this pursuit, right? Was there was when you got the movie, were they like, were they on board and excited? And was they there were, a studio they, were yeah, they on they, set with you or a studio teacher? Like
they were excited. But again, it was more in supporting my interests as a kid. Like they would have much rather me just play soccer on Saturday morning. Cool. Right? Okay.
Yeah, but I mean, you got, you know, but they weren't like stage parents where they were like, okay, this is huge.
And, no. And fortunately not. And that's, coming up in the industry, I saw some really dark stuff between parents and kids. And honestly, the reason why I didn't end up like a lot of the kids I grew up with in the industry was because my parents, right?
Yeah. And I ask that also to illustrate like that it's a really tough, like the majority of stories of kids who get work and start working, the stories don't go well. Your story is a good one.
Can you imagine like hitting the peak of your career at 13 years old, right? Like how that, and then not having a support group. Fortunately, that was not me. I did not hit the peak of my career. So I did the opposite, and that movie came out, and then I was humiliated. I was really embarrassed by it. Like I went on to do other acting stuff. And
you tell me again, like just because you know your dad says it's not a great movie, Michael. Did you recognize that at 11? It's harder, I think, sometimes at 10, 11 to identify. But were you aware of it? Were you like, oh man?
Oh yeah. No, at that time, because in my mind, I was like, well, maybe. You know, I thought it was like I'm making the next, I don't know, Poltergeist or E.T.
Sure.
Or something in my brain, right? So it's different. And then all of a sudden you see, you know, goblins running in potato sacks with masks that are far from believable. It was an immediate like, oh, this is not movie magic. And yeah, so I knew. And then it was continually... You know, I at that time it was like, oh boy, okay, not a good movie. I'll just, you know, keep acting. But Troll 2 never went away. Strangely, like I had an uncle. So just to kind of tell you where my brain was at that time, once I realized it was what it was, I went to the TV Guide and the Sunday newspaper every week, hoping. Because soon after that, it was programmed on HBO late night television. And every week I hoped that I would not see Troll 2 listed. And it was continually, and the way they graded it, they had, you know, a star system. But then below the half star, there was an icon of a turkey. And every time there was the turkey, and every week or so, my uncle would call me and say, Michael, you're terrible. Movie's on again. And they won't stop playing it.
Oh, man. That, I can't imagine. I mean, it's funny, but that's the part where I start to get sad because as a kid, that's the last thing you need, right? Like, that must have been awful.
It's true.
It just must have been an extremely painful. Yeah.
It was embarrassing and was like, and you know, and I got cast in other things that were on the surface seemed more notable, but in the end really weren't, strangely. Like the way that Troll 2, the irony of it all is, and this goes to your question of how I got into docs was, you know, I always wanted to be a filmmaker. Like I, early on, even while I was acting, I had a Sony TRV 900 and I was recording everything. And in my brain, I was always like, I want to make movies. And as I grew up, I grew up skateboarding. And so I was making the skate films and acting and always wanted to tell stories and ended up moving to LA, it was probably 16 years ago.
Oh, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Utah. Yeah.
And where did Troll 2 shoot? How did they cast you if you were in Utah?
Well, so it shot in Utah. So Utah at that time was actually pretty prolific for film production just because of the tax incentive program. I was living in Utah. That's where I grew up, and the Italians ended up in Utah, of all places, to make their horror movie. And so I auditioned there, and we filmed it just outside of Park City over the course of about 3 weeks.
Got it.
So moved to LA, and I was writing at the time, and I was...
And this is like a older, now we're talking more like your 20s or...
That's right. I would have been 27 at this point, 26 maybe. And the dream was make films. And I was writing something. I was writing in just a narrative at the time, and I was working, I was editing and shooting and working a lot of different odd jobs. And out of nowhere, I started getting messages from kids on MySpace of all places. we all remember MySpace. And these messages were, "Are you the kid from Troll 2? And it was this moment of like, oh my, this thing, this movie is never going to go away. What is going on? And what was interesting, it was all around this period of time where these kids were contacting me, and they'd send me pictures of them like having parties and dressing up and pissing on food or whatever it was, right? And they all thought they were the only ones doing it. And all of a sudden, I had this moment where I woke up one morning and I was talking to my wife. I'm like, I'm the child star of the worst film ever made. Like, there's a great, there's a great story here, and I can make it now. I don't have to wait. I can pick up a camera now. And this was before all the screenings. It's before it became a phenomenon. And then that led to about 4 years of chasing that story. And it was that doc that put a blip on the radar for me as
best worst movie, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you tell the story well. It's amazing. You know, we're about the same age. I grew up in LA. If when I was 10, I was cast in something, I would have been over the moon. And I can only imagine what the whole experience is like of having that happen, having it turn bad, or the realization, still wanting to be in the industry, coming out here, and then finding it chasing you. And if I remember correctly, around that time, that, you know, if the movie came out 2009, so it would have been like 2005, I think it sounds like, right? That you were like, okay, I'm going to do this.
Right.
There was such a fascination in the culture here in Los Angeles. Like, the bad movies of the era, like Mystery Science Theater 3000, like growing up on stuff like that.
Or yeah.
Like, I remember friends getting together and watching screening of things like everything from Manos to the Hands. Like, bad movies are a culture unto themselves. And of course, The Room ended up being the thing that like blew up on another scale. But the idea that you saw all that happening, you truly turned lemons into lemonade. Like, I mean, and that's like with an awareness. And I think that the degree of difficulty on that is worth mentioning, because God, so many people, like, you know, around, like the kid who plays Anakin Skywalker, like, there's so many bad stories, and there's so many situations where people can't get over either the ego, the self-awareness, like there's so many traps here, and somehow somewhere within you, you like avoided all that, and you turned it into a really good, funny, self-aware thing that launched a career for you, really.
Right.
So I think it's amazing. Like, and I, you know, the question, I guess, is like, because now you have a new one out, Attack of the Murder Hornets, which we're here to talk about, but the experience of making that doc, where you're like, docs are the thing. This is what I want to do. I love this.
Yeah. So it's funny because, like, I made Best Worst Movie because I could, and it felt like it was something I could pick up my camera and shoot. And this was before anything had happened with respect to the screenings or any of the phenomenon. It just felt, or it felt like something was about to happen, and I could capture it. I love docs, and I love nonfiction, and, like, you know, it's like, I love, like, Grey Gardens is one of my favorite movies ever, and an American Movie, obviously, like, I love.
I was going to say, like, how many times, like, I used to watch American Movie constantly because every struggle to make a movie, like, I loved it. And so I would imagine you've spent a lot of time with American Movie as well.
Yes, very much so. And, you know, like, my second doc was obviously The American Scream, and my first doc's Best Worst Movie, and nobody knows, but in my mind, mind, I was always like, between the two, I'm paying homage to American Movie. And I love that film on a number of levels. And I love, but primarily because of characters. And the thing with docs, I never got into it like, oh, I'm going to just make docs. I'm drawn to characters. And it just so happens the Best Worst Movie, obviously, has some. And my next film, also, I focused on characters. And then, you know, after that, I did a Netflix dark comedy that was scripted with Bob Odenkirk.
Yeah.
Completely different. And then this is a doc, obviously. And so I kind of am in this space where it's like, I don't really care what the format is or the genre, you know. It's like, this wasn't even in my head. Attack of the Murder Hornets wasn't even in my head. It's like, oh, this is a natural history doc. I was like, I just want to tell character stories. And that's the thing that gives me enough gas to see it through to the end, is if I can get engaged with the people that I'm centered on within my stories, then it will fascinate me until I finish. And that's the only thing that keeps me interested.
How much, so, you know, Best Worst Movie, you're a character. Your experience of it and even your retelling of it, how much of that plays into your perspective as a character? Obviously, Girlfriend's Day is a little separate, but as a filmmaker, as the man behind the camera. And then I also want to ask, what camera did you shoot Best Worst Movie on back in 2005?
So Best Worst Movie, I shot it on DVX-100A.
I remember that one, yeah.
I was so excited because it was like 23.98 frames per second. You know, it was really like,
yeah,
you
yeah.
know, what you're watching. So loved that, and ended up the other person that was shooting with me, of all people, this wonderful gal named Katie Graham, who's also a filmmaker now. Her and her boyfriend were just fans of Troll 2. And early on, they had made a sort of viral video that made Troll 2 look like this very endearing, like, drama, kind of like Little Miss Sunshine or something. It was brilliant. And they sent it to me, and I was like, I need help in this documentary. And so all of a sudden we were all over the world trying to make this thing. So I knew at the beginning I didn't want, like, I love characters. And I knew at the beginning, even though I was the kid in this movie, that my role was limited in terms, I didn't want to turn the camera on me and be like, hey, this is my, I'm going to tell you about my story. Like, I wanted to get people into the story. But it was a moment that I actually had in New York. It was the very first screening of Troll 2 at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater. And I remember thinking, soon after kids contacted me on MySpace, all of a sudden the UCB emails me and is like, hey, we're doing the screening. We'd really love it if you would come. And I thought, well, shoot, like, this, I have to go because now I'm making a documentary about it. So I went, and I was in the cab with George going towards the theater, and there was a line wrapped around the block. We didn't think it was for Troll 2. We got out of the car, we're walking towards the theater, and the line erupted with pure joy because they recognized George, the guy who played my father in the film. Yeah. And I remember it raining and George's face just being like, Michael, come on, this is great. And he ran over and everyone's like high-fiving him and he's signing autographs. And I'm standing in this rainy street and I'm like, this guy was in Alabama yesterday drilling cavities. Like, this, this is the story. And that was the moment where I was like, wow, this is his movie ultimately. And yeah.
I love that. That's the thing that I love about your movie, but also like what the American Movie thing, which is like, we laugh, but there's something so, it's like Ed Wood, you know, yeah. That's one of the best narrative versions of it. But,
yeah.
You know, the magic, like you said, there was the movie magic when you were on the set of Troll 2, but then, but the movie magic is there eventually. Like, it's a beautiful thing, right? Like,
yes.
Like Mark Borchardt's commitment to his thing is beautiful and so relatable. And, and I love that. I love that anecdote of seeing him signing the autographs and just loving every second of it.
Well, and let's face it, like, you know, and I don't know why, as you were speaking, it kind of sparked in that, like, filmmaking and the creative process, it's a messy process, right? Like warts and all, failure, starts, all these sorts of things. But you rarely get a look at that. And a lot of times when you're seeing making ofs or this or that, it doesn't include warts and all. It's the success of it all. And it's not that way. Like things like American Movie, where you realize, man, just how passionate they are, but what a look it is into just that process, right? Mm-hmm. Besser's movie, same thing. Like just the process of it all.
It's a look at how difficult it is.
Yeah.
All you have is the dream.
Yeah.
Like you have nothing else. You may not have the full knowledge. You certainly don't have the money. You may not have the IP or the content. You may not have, all you have is the wish. Yeah. And how far can the wish take you?
Yeah.
And sometimes not very far, and that's okay too. But we just love that, you know, and that's what, like, talking your story about him in the rain signing it is like, it's beautiful. That's just that's what it is. Like, it's almost better and purer than the version that's the highest end success.
It's true. I'd agree. Yeah. No, I agree.
But so you follow, what it feels like is you follow people, and Murder Hornets is a great example of, like, you know, it was a buzzy thing. It was this crazy thing happening, right? It was the whole idea was, oh my God, another absurd thing. And I think just when people hear Murder Hornets, they're like, what is it? Is it, you know, fiction? Is somebody like, and I think what's great about it is that you found a funny, sweet human side within a story that was kind of like crazy and absurd, right?
Yeah. Well, that makes me happy. I mean, it is, you know, when I read the headline similar in the New York Times, it was like, oh wow, now we have Murder Hornets. Like, we were all having a horrible moment where nobody was going anywhere. And I read that article, and then I was drawn into the characters who were against, you know, who were basically against all odds expected to try to stop this. And I had never considered, well, what does it mean to try to stop an invasive species? Like, this seems almost impossible. Right. And it just so happens that it's a giant hornet, and it just so happens that there's no resources, and it's just, so, I mean, and so I think in looking back, like that has been same best, worst movie, you know, American Scream, Attack of the Murder Hornets. Like it all starts with this, for me, this feeling of interesting characters who are facing almost impossible odds. Right. And the dream may be to make a, you know, a horror movie from an Italian director who it's his real passion project, or the dream may be to make a haunted house and to be successful in the haunted house industry, or the dream may be I want to eradicate a species. All those things are very, very hard, if not impossible. And so I think that was initially like this, you know, this feeling of like, how is this going to work? And it was a mixture of scientists and beekeepers and these folks who were like on the front lines of this, of something that could become a very big problem for the country.
Yeah. I mean, they're also trying to protect their own turf, right? Like the dream was like, how do we on our own without, like, I think that's also a through line, like people without a lot of resources or without, like, on their own, kind of on the front line of something that are just like, okay, we'll do our best, which is like endearing, hysterical, sad. Like, it's this whole mixture of human feelings. And that's the thing that, like, that I think carries it through. It's like, who are these poor people that have, like, just like suffering in this circumstance? Like, and I think that it's, people shouldn't get distracted by or lost in the whole, like, what the national narrative of Murder Hornets was, which from a big far away perspective, it's almost like, was that even real? Like, was that a real thing, or did someone just make that up one day? But this is like the human, like, no, some people actually really suffered with this. Right. I mean, you got in the suit, you got stung, right?
I got stung by bees, of all things, believe it or not. Nobody got stung by a hornet. Fortunately, that wouldn't have been good. And the only time I wore the actual Hornet suit, which is crazy.
The Hornet suit looks kind of like a Mercury spacesuit. Like, it's insane looking.
It's true. It's a wild, I think Colbert actually said we looked like shaved Teletubbies. but a very wild, suit that we only got in. We got in when we were, actually eradicating the nest. Prior to that, I was in bee suits if I was around bees. And the only time I got stung actually was we were shooting bees at night, and there's a swarm, and you're out there and it's dark and the bees are swarming you, and it makes this incredibly beautiful sound. Like, you place it kind of vibrates like the blood inside of you. Like, it just feels really weird. And all of a sudden I look and I see, this hornet crawling up my face net, and I focus on it, like right in front of my nose, and I focus on it, and all of a sudden, and I'm like, wait a minute, this thing is actually on the inside of my suit. And seconds after that, I got stung, and then I had left a tiny little hole open in my bee suit, and within like a minute, I had 7 or 8 stings. So that was the only time that I got stung, and it was because my own stupidity.
But that's how simple it is for them to get in.
Yeah.
But the hornets are actually pretty scary. Like, they decapitate the bees. They have these crazy stingers, right? They're like, they're no joke.
And they
even though it became a joke, they are no joke.
They not only sting you and can, like, multiple times, but they spray venom. I won't forget the first time seeing one, because it really is this impressionable creature where it's just so robust. You look at it and you're like, wow, this thing is, it just feels like a toy, or it feels like a weird alien species, right? And they're such a character. Like, you look at their face and the character is just like, I'm going to mess you up.
That's why it lends itself so much, like, even beyond the name, to the sci-fi horror stuff of an era, which is they embody it.
Right.
Discover why critics are calling Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes the best film of the franchise.
What a wonderful day!
It's a jaw-dropping spectacle that demands to be seen on the biggest screen possible.
I need to go.
Hang on. It is our time.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Now playing only in theaters. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
You know, I want to jump back, though, and talk about, because we're talking about the docs, Making Girlfriends Day for Netflix, which is a movie with a great cast. I mean, Bob Odenkirk, Amber Tamblyn, Stacey Keach, to name, and there's others, Andy Richter. Like, how did this come about? Like, and this stands apart in your resume, right?
Well, it was interesting. I was actually editing The American Scream, which was my second doc, and I was having a conversation with my wife around actors who we felt had really strong dramatic sensibilities, who were primarily known in, the comedic space. And we were doing the dumb thing where we were writing names down on our whiteboard. And at that time, it was like season 2 of Breaking Bad. So we knew Bob from Mr. Show and from his comedy days. And then we saw Breaking Bad happen. And it was like more and more that the general public was getting to know this guy, and we were huge fans. And so, like, I wrote down on my whiteboard, I was like, man, this Bob Odenkirk would be amazing. And again, this was season 2 of Breaking Bad.
He just showed up basically, right?
Yeah. As I was editing, 3 weeks later, the AV Club did an interview with Bob. I believe it was the AV Club. And they asked him what some of his favorite films were. And he named Best Worst Movie. So it was this moment of like, what? And so we got in touch. Turns out his son was a big Troll 2 fan. just bizarre. And I was like, hey, I'm finishing my second doc. Totally different, but we're going to show it in LA. Would love to have you come. And he's like, I'd love to come. And I just kind of thought, oh, he won't come. And sure enough, he did. And he was there early. And it was at the Cine Family in LA. And yeah. He starts talking to me. He's like, look, he's like, I got this really weird script that will never get made, but I'd love for you to take a look at it, you know. And he starts telling me about Girlfriend's Day. And at that time, so soon after that, he sent me the script. And at that time, I read it and was just like taken by just how it was like so many genres within one movie, and was like, man, this is hard and challenging. And it's a story about a failed greeting card writer in this greeting card world who gets thrust into this web of murder and deceit, and it's dark and it's light. It just felt, and of course, working with Bob, it was like, this feels like a dream. So we went through a period of trying to get that made. And then ultimately Netflix became what it is. You know, this was early Netflix. Like, this, I think, was one of the early original movies. And then it got to the point to where it was inevitable. And Netflix was like, yeah, we'll do it. And we ended up shooting it in LA over the course of 20 days.
Wow, 20 days.
Yeah.
It's funny because, yeah, so Bob wrote it with another Mr. Aaron. Show.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's just funny thinking, yeah, I knew of Bob growing up watching Mr. Show, loving it, thinking he was hilarious, but he was not like major on the radar. And then sometime in the aughts, like, I worked a few times on stuff Bob was directing because he was doing a bunch of internet shorts and I was just around the comedy world. So I interacted and worked with him a few times. And then when Breaking Bad happened and he was in this serious role and everybody in the world starts talking about Bob, and you're just like, Bob Odenkirk is the funny guy from Mr. Show. Like, this is so weird. But what I love about your whiteboard thing and identifying this, and of course, there's a lot of serendipity that follows, which is like, he loved your movie. You saw each other at the screening, but you had this thought of, it's a great lesson for anybody out there, like, who is looking to make perhaps or capable of making a career move, a jump that I can help facilitate or be involved in? Like, actors who have the ability to get behind a project, that's kind of how you end up getting something made in a lot of cases. So your thought process, your experiment of who's like that, who would be interesting to stretch with, and it worked out, you know, that someone on your list ended up being someone who was a fan of yours.
It's
but
wild.
Just making that list is great. That's a great way to approach, like, what do I want to do? How do I want to get the next thing made?
It's wild. I mean, and also to Bob, I mean, you know, Bob showed such trust and support early on that it was like, it was remarkable, because it's not as though he never questioned me. I just continually questioned myself, like, wait, what? Why? Are you sure? Like, I'm going to screw all this up. For whatever reason, like, he just didn't. And that was a big deal.
I mean, I think people who see him now, you know, between Better Call Saul, Nebraska, and he's got the new one coming out, people don't realize that he put so much effort into helping develop talent. Like, he EP'd countless comedy pilots. He worked with so many people I know and helped develop them or helped try to champion them. And he put himself in so much stuff. He directed stuff or he acted, like, just always trying to build up basically like a minor leagues, but also just get himself out there. So he's like, he's worked to get to here. Like, he's continually. So I was like, we see the tip of the iceberg, you know, he's one of those examples.
That was another huge example, which for me was I'm so grateful for, is he works hard, right? Like, he is continually working, and it is his output across so many different lanes is just never one thing, which is kind of inspiring. And you hear early on in your career, sometimes at some point, like, you got to find the one thing and make that the best thing and be as passionate as you can about that one thing. At least I heard this, and now I look at it, I'm like, no, you need to find 12 things. Like, you know, like, because that's, it's just how the business is. You have to really be continually working and developing, because when one project pauses or stops or dies, another one begins. I mean, it's.
Yeah, no, it's true. He planted so many seeds, and I walked, like, I was around a lot of them that like some of them went nowhere, but eventually stuff grew in that garden. Like crazy stuff no one would have expected, but like he just put so much out there, and I just watch it. I watch him throw himself hard into directing little internet shorts that had like a 3-person crew and 2 people in the cast. Like the guy, he took it all seriously. So, but I mean, I think that vibe is part of what you're talking about.
It's like, yeah. And he doesn't, it's not as though, oh, it's, you know, I remember when we were making Girlfriend's Day, you know, there was rumors about Saul, Better Call Saul. And it was at that point, it was a joke to him. He's like, I can never, what? This is ridiculous. This will never happen. You know, and it was just nothing more than sort of like, oh, funny, but not. And I remember thinking, I don't know, like Bob, like, this is going to happen. But it was interesting because he doesn't take things too seriously either. Like, I mean, I think you can get so precious about everything and this and that. And Bob's an incredible example of just being like, let's work hard, do our best, and then we'll do it again on the next thing. It can be completely different. We'll just keep working.
Yeah. Like, so tell me that I want to get back before we wrap to Attack of the Murder Hornets again, because it's out. It's covered, like, it's a movie, but it's also like a piece of science. Like it's kind of crossing over a little bit. Like, what has the response been, and like, what's been interesting about experiencing it being out in the world as a person who's, you know, made narrative films, docs, but really you're in the entertainment industry. This is kind of about things that go beyond entertainment. Obviously this is a step out. You're not a nature documentary.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. It's funny because I've had folks that have been like, oh, were you considering that you were making a natural history documentary? And you know what? I wasn't. Like, in my mind, I was making, from the very beginning, I was making a character-driven story that was centered on around people trying to stop the threat of a giant hornet. And never in my mind, I knew I would encounter science and learn a lot of great things about beekeepers and hornets, but never in my mind was like, oh, I'm making a natural history doc. And I think from the beginning, it was also like, this feels like a Stranger Than Fiction, sci-fi, drama, horror movie. Like, the first piece of art I created around it was like reminiscent of like a 50s horror movie or something, where I had a gigantic hornet hovering above my scientist. So in my head, it was always like, I am making a character driven piece, just different world. Their world happens to be hornets and invasive species. And I think, like, whether it's whatever it is, I don't get drawn to like political issues or specific topics per se. I get drawn to like, what's at stake with these people, right? And if I can relate to them and have a genuine respect for them, then what happens is the themes that they care about, the science that's at hand, the topics, all of that gets smuggled in through entertainment. And ultimately, I think that's the power of entertainment, is if you can relate, if you can create something that not only engages people on a human level, but gets them to, you know, have a slightly different perspective on the world or some of the things that these people encounter within their world. Now all of a sudden people are learning science, or they're considering the impact of bees, or all of a sudden they're like, man, public service, like, people, these guys are heroes, you know? And that's the sort of thing that I get excited about.
So was Discovery involved the whole way through, or did they acquire you at a
no,
certain point?
No. So it's funny, because I read the article in New York Times, was immediately like, kind of, I had this challenge of like, well, I can't go anywhere, so what can I create around it. Like, I wanted to do something. So I ended up Zooming with some of the scientists and doing some research and putting it together. And then I was going to pitch it. And my wife was like, why not Discovery? And I was like, this was before nobody even knew about Discovery. This was like June or July. Discovery Plus wasn't even a thing. And I was like, I'd never worked with Discovery. Like, I had never had an experience with them. And so I thought, okay, well, yeah, why not? And ended up Zooming. My first meeting with them was with my executive producer, Howard Schwartz, and ended up Zooming with them from my closet. And we really connected. Like, I felt this incredible support creatively right off the bat. And Howard was really into horror and genre movies. And it went so, like, beyond how to be honest, going into it, I thought there's no way Discovery is going to get behind a film about a giant hornet. And the Zoom went so well. And I had my wife and kids, I had them leave the house because it was just madness. And they came back, and my wife came back and she's like, well, how did it go? And I had this moment. I think the next movie is going to be about this giant hornet. and you have to understand, like, weeks prior to that, wasn't even in my head. Hadn't even thought about it.
It's crazy.
And then next thing I knew, we were headed to Northern Washington. And even at that time, you know, like, there's no, you step in, there wasn't a guarantee we'd find a single hornet, right? Yeah. And so you're out on a limb, and Discovery, like, and Howard, I mean, I felt nothing but positivity and support and encouragement. And even just, like, you know, even creatively, early on in one of our early meetings, Howard was like, well, are you guys going to shoot drones? I was like, yeah, we'll shoot drones. We're going to shoot some stuff from the woods, and we're going to create this atmosphere. It kind of pays a little bit of nod to horror films. He's like, well, what about Hornet POV with a drone? And to be honest, I'd considered drones, but I'd never considered having a drone that would articulate in such a way that would be flying through narrow spaces in the forest. And like a hornet. And at that moment it was like, well, shoot, I can't let Howard down. So now I've got to figure out racing drones and figure out how I can get smaller drones into some of these spaces. So it was a dream working with Discovery on this. I know it was just a continual reinforcement of, like, you know, we support this, we support you, we believe in the story, we believe in you, all of these. It was really incredible.
It's just so cool. And we talk a lot about how all these streamers and how, you know, Discovery, for example, gets into the original content business. All these things create new opportunities for people, new avenues where there's a niche that it might fit with, and places where you can be creative and the creativity is fostered. And this is just the perfect example of that, which is, like, you never would have saw it coming in the business model of 10, 15, 20 years ago. You would have had limited places to take it, but this is the perfect place. Like, right. And they love it and they want to do it, and they want to do it the way you want to do it. Like, right. And that is something that comes about because of the way the industry is kind of nicheifying.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's true.
Well, that's really cool. So people can watch it on Discovery Plus, right?
Yeah. People are just starting to discover it, which is exciting. You know, again, you make something and you really, me at least, like, you really get obsessed with it and the world and the characters. And then you just hope that some point in time somebody watches it, and
which is a far cry from checking TV Guide filled with dread
isn't it
day,
yeah,
on Sunday to make sure to find out if they're gonna see you with the trolls.
Yeah,
but again, that ended up being an amazing thing that you turned that into lemonade, right?
I mean if you that's the, that is, and I can't tell, here's how much it's it's screwed me up, George, is I cannot, I can no longer tell you that Troll 2 is a bad film, right? Like, Troll 2 is actually one, has not only afforded me with experiences that I've never would have imagined, but I've created relationships with people that I will hold with me till the day I die, right? Like, and then career-wise, personally, I mean, it's like I owe everything to Claudio Fragasso making his film about these goblins. Like, it's wild. And it's just
sort of also amazing, because what can so easily destroy people and destroy lives, literally, or destroy careers, destroy lives. Like, I mean, childhood stardom destroys people. It's tragic.
Yeah. Yeah,
but let alone in something that like it was a place of creation for you. That's a pretty overwhelming and powerful thing. So it's a beautiful story and a funny one. But but congratulations on the film, and thanks so much for coming on,
George. It's a pleasure. I really enjoy talking to you, and thanks for the thoughtfulness and
of course, well,
and watching
likewise.
Movies in the first place.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks, Michael, for coming on the show. I'm a huge fan of bad movies, but I love a redemption story. And it's just so cool to me that Michael took something that would bury most people and parlayed that, leveraged that into an exciting new career that is really still just blossoming with Murder Hornets and with whatever comes next. So that's always exciting to see happen in the real world, to know that just because things aren't going well, or just because you've created something that people don't like, people really don't like, doesn't mean you're done. You can get up off the mat and impress us all. Be sure to check out all kinds of stories on nofilmschool.com. Make sure to check out our gear guides. If you're interested in buying any kind of gear or learning about what's available out there, the gear guides section is at the bottom of our homepage. You scroll all the way down to the footer, you'll see gear guides. Click on that and you'll see a breakdown of all kinds of tools that we have scoured and reported on for you to make the decision about what to buy. And of course, we have our weekly podcast on the same feed. Make sure to like, rate, and subscribe. And leave a comment to let us know what you think. Thanks so much.